Daniel, if you'd like to start.
Yeah, okay, thanks Jason. Yeah, I'm only going to give half a speech in my introduction, just because Jason insists on me only speaking for 10 minutes. And the meeting is billed as something like, is economic growth feasible and desirable? So I'm going to concentrate on the desirability aspect in my 10 minutes, because if it's not desirable, then, you know, hey, why worry about feasibility? I think, you know, better first of all to focus on the desirability of growth, but then I'm quite happy in the discussion to talk about whether it's feasible or not, which is a kind of logically latter discussion, although obviously important to have if you think it's desirable. And it is important to recognise that a lot of people do think that growth is undesirable or at least problematic. I mean, even if you speak to ordinary people, they might say, yeah, you know, I'd like to be richer, I'd like to be better off. But there is quite a widespread sense that things are getting worse, that even though the economy, generally speaking, is growing, although obviously we've had a recent recession, but generally the trend is for the economy to grow, but people in many respects are getting worse off. I think that's a common sense, quite widely held view. And it's also a view that is held by a lot of very prominent academics who get Nobel Prizes and advise governments on this question. I think on this, Professor Sen and I probably agree that probably the consensus view among academics, among economists, for example, including people like Amartya Sen, I don't know if you're a relation to Amartya Sen, but same surname, but Professor Amartya Sen is a very prominent development economist, Nobel Prize winner, Joseph Stiglitz, and lots of others. The consensus view, I would say, among most economists is that economic growth is, at the very least, problematic. They wouldn't say they're against growth, generally speaking. But they would mostly say that it's problematic in some serious ways. And I want to argue the contrary, that economic growth, by which I mean really increasing economic output, producing more stuff, if you want to put it crudely, does have real benefits to human beings. And far from it being kind of anti-human to argue for economic growth, which is a very common view, certainly among Greens, in fact, that the humanist attitude to growth is to want to have more growth, to have more prosperity. I'm clearly not arguing that there are no problems in the world and that the world is perfect. Some people have accused me of that in reviews, which is completely bizarre. I think there are serious problems in the world. But my contention is that to deal with those problems, we'll be in a better position if we have more growth and more prosperity. And that particularly the poorest people in the world, they certainly won't benefit from having less growth. They benefit from having more growth. And it would be a disaster for them, in fact, if the world economy stopped growing, let alone if it went into reverse. So, I mean, just to give a few examples of how growth has been beneficial. I'm not going to bombard you with statistics, partly because I'm not brilliant at remembering statistics. I tend to have to look them up each time. But one statistic to remember, which I think is really stunning, probably my favourite statistic, is if you take average global life expectancy, the average time that a person is likely to live, if you compare the average person in 1800, which we can debate the exact date, but roughly speaking is probably the period when economic growth really took off. Before that, economic growth was probably very slow. Some argue there wasn't much growth at all, like Gregory Clark. But you compare average global life expectancy in 1800, it was about 30. Average global life expectancy in 2008, which is the latest figure I've been able to get, was 69, almost, you know, touching on 70. I mean, that is, just thinking about that, I mean, clearly longevity, life expectancy isn't the whole story in terms of humanity. There are lots of other areas to talk about, but that is a staggering statistic. The average global life expectancy has more than doubled in a period of just over 200 years. I think that is one measure of how beneficial economic growth has been to humanity. And it's very, very important to recognise that that is a global figure. That is not just among the Western elite or the West. That is a global figure. So even people in poor countries, even countries like India and China, there have been huge increases in average life expectancy. And even if you take the worst countries in the world in terms of life expectancy, somewhere like Zimbabwe, where I think average life expectancy is probably, I think it's 46, something like that. I mean, that is pretty terrible. And I clearly would prefer Zimbabwe to be on a level of the West. I want Zimbabwe to grow and be much richer. But even if you compare Zimbabwe with life expectancy is 46 to someone's life chances in Britain in 1800, I'd say it's much better off being in Zimbabwe in 2008 or 2010, we had the stats, than you would be in Britain in 1800. And of course, as I said, life expectancy is only one measure, albeit an important one. There are lots of other measures. You know, pretty much every measure, if you take a long-term view, you can see huge improvements in terms of not just life expectancy, but the average age at which you have the onset of chronic disease, literacy, if you look at global measures of literacy. It used to be the case that it was only an elite in the third world, for example, that were literate. Now the vast majority of people are literate. Things could clearly still improve, as I've said, but you know, lots of other measures. Mobile phones, for example. You know, it used to be at the end of the 80s, a few lucky people in the West had like big brick-like mobile phones that they carried around with them, and most of the rest of us were really envious of these mobile phones that they had. Now, there are estimated to be about 4 billion mobile phone subscribers in the world. More than 4 billion mobile phones, but some people have more than one. But the number of individual subscribers is about 4 billion. And even places in Africa and Asia, you know, even remote villages, you have now a lot of people with mobile phones. Completely staggering. I think one of the problems in relation to understanding the benefits of growth is that it's often understood very narrowly. It's often understood in terms of stuff. So people will say, well, you know, well, it's just about, you know, people having more flat-screen colour televisions or iPhone 4s, like I think Jason has got. You know, it's just about those kind of horrible consumer things. And, I mean, I think it's absolutely fair for people to have consumer goods. If people want to have flat-screen televisions, that's fine by me. I wouldn't be snobbish about it. If they want to watch football or whatever on a large flat-screen television or have a fancy iPhone. In fact, I wish I had one, but that's all fine by me. But I think that is a very narrow way to understand prosperity as well. It's not just an attachment to consumerism and individual consumer goods. Because it's not just the case that we have the same as we had in 1800, but we just have more of it. I would say an integral part of economic growth is that not only do we have more stuff, but we have much better stuff. So, you know, the mobile phone example, you know, 30 years ago, no one really had a mobile phone. Now, a very large number of people, including in the third world, have mobile phones. Maybe the favourite example of economic historians is someone called Nathan Rothschild, who was perhaps the richest man in the world in the mid-19th century. And he died, as far as we can tell, from an infected abscess. Nowadays, that could be treated. You could go to the local chemist to get antibiotics. And treat it for a few pence, and you know, he'd be fine. But he was the richest man in the world in the mid-19th century and died from this abscess. So, and to me, what that shows is that the growth has this benefit, not just of us having more stuff, but it's very closely related to scientific and technological development and to innovation. So not only do we have more of what we had before, but we have new things. And it's also very wrong, I think, to understand it in narrow individualistic terms. In other words, it's not just about individual consumer goods that we have. Because if you want to talk about it in terms of stuff, you have to understand it in broad social terms as well. So it's things like the electricity grid, roads, airports, telecoms, all of these things, and also hospitals, schools, universities. You know, up until 1800, either they didn't exist at all. In the case of the electricity grid, for example, I think in Britain it was only in the 1920s when it started to take off. Either it didn't exist at all, or it was really the preserve of a tiny elite. So, for example, universities. You know, only a tiny elite would enjoy an education up until the period of modern economic growth. Now, we at least have the means and the resources to give most people, and certainly in the West, the benefit of an education. We can argue about the quality of education. I know there are people here who feel passionately about that. I don't want to get into that argument. But at least in principle, if we have resources, we have the resources to give people a proper education. And as I've said, even in the third world now, the levels of literacy are increasing and have increased enormously and look set to continue to increase. So huge benefits to growth, both in terms of human welfare, in terms of incomes, very important, in terms of, you know, what we have. What some people argue, of course, is that, well, yeah, that was all very well in the past, but now we're reaching a stage, they'll say, at least we're reaching a stage in the West where economic growth is no longer beneficial. So it was okay in the past, and maybe it's okay in the third world, but it's no longer beneficial in the West. And I would argue that's also the wrong way to look at it. There are still lots of benefits to be had from economic growth in the West. That doesn't mean that, you know, forever that will be the case. It may be, we may reach a stage at some point where we think, yeah, okay, let's not strive for economic growth. But I think we're very far from that stage now. I think, yeah, I mean, it's all very well, particularly for these kind of very rich environmentalists. So you do get these kind of billionaire environmentalists to say, you know, people shouldn't be better off. But I think even if you take Britain today, you know, people could benefit a lot more from higher living standards. Even on that very simple level, I think we should still say people should have higher living standards, they'd be better off with more material resources. I think also in relation to the third world, not to talk about the third world itself, because I think it's very apparent why there needs to be more growth. But I think also the third world benefits from economic growth in the West, because it means we have more technology, they can benefit from that technology. It means we can buy goods produced in the third world. It means we can sell goods more efficiently to the third world. So you can't really separate the West and the third world in that way, the third world or the South or whatever you're meant to call it nowadays. I get confused by the terminology. But it can still benefit from growth in the West enormously. A couple more reasons before I wind up. One is the so-called demographic problem. And the idea here is that the population is aging. That means we're inevitably going to get poorer. We're going to have all these old people who won't be able to work. And we've got fewer people to support them. And therefore, we're inevitably going to get poorer. And apart from that having a very kind of narrow, demeaning view of the elderly, many of whom are pretty fit and vibrant, not all seriously ill by any means. But apart from that, it misses the point that the way that we've managed to deal with more dependence in the past and the way we're likely to do it in the future is by having a more productive, more productive, vibrant society that can produce more. So even if we have fewer people who are in work, we can give people who can't work for whatever reason a decent standard of living. It may be that they're children, so obviously that they don't go out to work. It may be that they're elderly. It may be that they're disabled. It may just be that they're students who, you know, just studying full time. But if we have a kind of vibrant core economy, then we have the wealth and the resources to keep dependents in a decent standard of living. But the precondition for that is to have economic growth. And finally, climate change, because I know, I mean, inevitably, I think in a discussion like this, someone, probably more than one person, will raise the question of climate change. And I would argue, I'm not going to get into the discussion of climate change itself, but I think a key problem with the assumption behind the discussion of climate change in relation to the economy, the core assumption is that what we need to do is to rein in economic growth, curb consumption, and that's the best way to deal with climate change. We need to ration things, we need to, you know, drive less, not keep our TV on standby, all this kind of stuff. That's the best way to deal with it. And I would say that that is absolutely wrong, because if we think it's a big problem to deal with, the best way to deal with it is not as a kind of moralistic, you know, you need to consume less problem, but a practical engineering kind of problem that we can deal with through economic growth and through developing the resources we need to develop the technology to tackle it. And this is a big subject, but it can be dealt with in lots of ways, and probably will be a combination of ways that we need to take to deal with it. It could be decarbonising the energy supply. So, for example, having more nuclear power stations, perhaps having solar power, but on a very large scale, perhaps having wind, geothermal, all sorts of things. So decarbonising the energy supply, moving away from fossil fuels over time to other forms of energy. But that demands a lot of investment. That is an expensive business. So in order to do that, you need economic growth. If you want to adapt, are you signalling to me that I've got 3 more minutes?
One more minute.
Okay, if you want to adapt, for example, building higher seawalls, then again, that costs money. You can do it. It is done in places like Florida and the Netherlands, but that costs money. If you want high-tech engineering solutions to climate change, like sucking carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere or deflecting the sun's rays in some way, these things are being discussed by scientists. Again, that costs money. So, I mean, really, because I can see Jason's going purple. So, really, just to sum up, I mean, I think economic growth has been enormously beneficial, is likely to continue to be beneficial for some time into the future. I'm certainly not saying the world is perfect. I'm certainly not saying that inequality doesn't exist. But I think to tackle future problems and to help out the mass of people in the world who still live in real poverty, we need more growth rather than less.